Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook, a podcast that brings transparency to top performers, careers, and topics. My name is Justin Hazard Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the Air Force. One of the most important lessons I've learned is that you have to be selective with who you listen to. There's a lot of noise out there. The goal of this podcast is to find experts who are at the top of their field to share their insights based on credibility and experience. My guest today is Jason Ramos, a firefighter currently in his 30th season. He spent over half his time as an air-delivered firefighter. Often called smoke jumpers, these professionals are highly trained and specialized firefighters who can parachute or rappel into a forest fire. They work independently in some of the most difficult terrain imaginable. Jason has over 270 jumps into fires and has also written the leading book on the profession titled Smoke Jumper. Today's episode is sponsored by Bremont. Over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Now here's a highlight from our conversation today.
It's zero to like 60 in seconds. Your adrenaline just, it's constantly spiking, constantly going down. And by that time, you know, we get it again. It's like, oh, is this going to be the real one? And we were headed to Oregon for reinforcement. So that means you're going. This is a going, working fire. We're going to support the Redmond smoke jumpers. And I remember getting on station, so we're over the fire. You know, as the plane goes around, there's smoke. And I remember feeling a little bit of the, you don't feel a lot of heat, but you feel the hot air and you smell the smoke as you're going through, as the plane's orbiting around the fire. And as the jumpers in front of you are getting briefed and they're exiting the aircraft, it's like, God, this is it. First fire.
In our conversation, we talk about what it's like to be in one of these infernos, the traits required of a smoke jumper, and dive into some of the tactics and equipment used to put out forest fires. If you're enjoying the show and want to keep up with me, you can follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I also send out a monthly newsletter. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com. Now, without further ado, Jason Ramos. All right, we're live. Jason, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure and honor.
So I was watching the TED Talk you gave, and in the beginning, there's a billowing fire, a video you play, and the flames are leaping up hundreds of feet, smoke billowing tens of thousands of feet, and you're right up on it. You're talking about the heat that you're feeling. Can you describe what's going on in that video?
Yeah, that was an interesting day. It was a four jumpers, and you know, remember we got on station getting on over the fire and it wasn't too bad. And, you know, it was big, a few acres at the time. And we jumped out and we landed. And usually when you have a four person, you know, load for that size of a fire, you kind of break up. You usually have a recon guy scouting out ahead for the fire line, where to put the fire line, the placement. And so I remember I was out that day scouting and it was, you know, probably about an hour and the fire was big. It turned pretty big. And at a point where that video comes in, that's the point where I was double timing, you know, fast pace up to a safe zone. You know, as a wildland firefighter, there's times that, you know, we're not perfect and we're trying to do our job out there. And there's times where you don't want to gamble, but you do. You're always pushing that envelope. You are. And that day, things were pretty extreme. The relative humidities, thunder cells in the area. And at that point, I knew our fire was going big. And in that video, it kind of gives a little piece of what we do when things are, I would say, active, because, you know, we're not usually out filming. There's no time to take the pictures. And some guys are very good at it, but there's a lot of heat. You know, you can hear my voice in the video. You can hear my breathing. That's unscripted. That's the real deal. And it came out so good. And we use it for folks to just give them a little piece of when we're out there, when things start to get exciting, as we say. So I remember at that time, right when the video ends there, I remember calling the jumper in charge. He's the first jumper out the door. And I asked him if he could see the head of the fire. And he says, not really. I said, well, you know, get to a high point. And he calls me back in a few minutes and he looks up and, you know, I give him degrees and a compass. I said, you know, look at this degrees. And he says, is that our fire? I said, yes, that is our fire. It's going to burn till wintertime. He says, are you sure that's our fire? I said, yep. So at that time, air attack, which is aircraft coordination, you know, they can coordinate all the air tankers and helicopters. They showed up on station there. And I remember it was within minutes that an incident commander in the air was saying, you know, pack it up and head to the safe zone. You guys are definitely not going to catch this one with four people. So that video just shows a little bit of when things get exciting. I don't know how else to say it. The video does its justice.
Yeah, it certainly does. Can you talk about what's going on inside of a forest fire? My only experience was growing up in Los Alamos, New Mexico. We had the Cerro Grande fire, and it burned 150,000 acres, 400 homes were lost. And coming back, the entire mountainside was just charred. It looked like an atom bomb went off. So can you describe what a forest fire, what's going on inside one of those things?
That was one of the hardest parts of my book to explain. You know, everyone has their own version, right? I'm sure you have your own version of what a jet sounds like or when you're taken off or all these different things. And, you know, I started fighting fire back in 1989. And as you get experience, I would always hear people, it sounds like a freight train. It sounds like a jet for years. And I'm like, it doesn't sound like a jet to me. And sure doesn't sound like a freight train to me. It sounds, I described in my book, it sounds kind of like a kind of analogy when two people start to argue and it just gets louder and louder and louder. And then your ears start to ring. It has its own sound, like a skunk has its own smell. A going fire is, you can blindfold someone and put some headphones onto while on fire. You can say, that's a going fire. And it's just chaos. So imagine, your campfire in your fireplace, right? You hear the sounds, you hear the oxygen, you hear breathing, and just times that to this huge number. And you can imagine acres of trees some trees might be 150 feet, 200 feet high, or chaparral brush that could be 50 feet. And then take acres and acres of that with a fire front and this ominous rumble. And that's what it sounds like. It's hard to explain. When you go through years of experience, it's like the video in there. I was starting to hear some of that. It's like, I need to leave. And sure enough, right, if I would have made a mistake or if I did certain things that day and not follow SOPs, standard ops, I probably wouldn't be talking to you. That's the game. You get to a point where it's so exacting. If you mess something up, that fire, again, it doesn't have any feelings. It's just hungry and it wants to eat. If you're in the way, you don't come home. So it's a pretty ominous thing.
And if these fires get big enough, they start making their own weather. Is that correct?
Correct. So when listeners listen to this or read my book, I always tell folks, if you're at a campfire or at home, you could notice some of these things on a smaller scale. You could see the fire breathe. You could see little fire whirls. You could see all these things in that shrunk down scale right in your own home or outside. And it's just, again, it's such an ominous thing. Still to this day, I study fire. When I left to come to this podcast, I was burning piles last week. And I'm always taken away when you're watching how this stuff happens. It's a chemical reaction. Yeah, I think people, again, if they read my book and listen to this podcast, they'll have a different respect when they're watching a fire. Next time they're having a campfire roasting their s'mores. And it's always something you're learning on. Again, you're always learning, why is it doing that? Why is it doing this? And it's just such an awe. Like I said, I remember hearing a firefighter years ago, and I was still a kid at the time, a young firefighter. He basically called this controlled pyros, pyromaniacs, and I'd have to agree with him. I'm usually burning something weekly, whether it be training or clearing out a piece of property.
And so where did the idea come from to let's parachute people into the middle of these fires?
The history is so rich, and there's still tidbits you still find today. The Forest Service started with the JUMP program back in 1939, but you got to remember research and design, R&D, they just didn't, get on a telegram or a memo back in 1939 and said, hey, next month we're going to start jumping out of planes. You're talking years of prep. And, we have some documentation dating back to, the mid-1930s. Mr. David Godwin, which was very fond of the parachute. They were using parachutes for supplying in supplies for, backcountry folks, whether it be a fire or someone's hurt, but they were using the parachutes. The military had parachutes in case we got shot out of aircraft. And doing some research with the 101st Airborne, they're still learning from us. We're still learning from them and all these other airborne units. So long story short, The program came to us in 1939. There was a company called the Eagle Parachute Company out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And these folks were doing it for fun. They were the, how do you say, the Red Bull guys at that time. And from what we were told, they were getting parachutes for the military and modifying them, right? And back then, there's no big box stores. These folks are obviously driving somewhere through mail, snail mail. They were picking these parachutes up. And they were the, again, the daredevils back at that time. The Forest Service heard about them. And the story goes, it was, you know, holiday season. And the Eagle Parachute Company, one of these jumpers jumped out and, you know, Santa Claus regalia. And somehow that got, you know, back then, photographers, newspapers was pretty much our way of information back then. And they say that's kind of how they say the Forest Service heard about it, but we don't have any proof of that. So at that time, the Forest Service was in communication with the Eagle Parachute Company, and they decided to come to Winthrop, Washington. It was the North Cascades Mountains, so very rough terrain. If you ever flown over the North Cascades and you look north, you just see nothing but rock spires as far as your eye can see. And there was a lot of regional foresters at that time for the Forest Service that didn't like the idea of the parachute. So you can imagine if you were a chief or regional forester and they came to you and said, Justin, we're going to use the parachute. And you're like, huh? Only one at the time that was using the parachute we know was Germany to invade other countries. That was World War I going into World War II. So they all came to Winthrop, Washington. I would think from the pictures that we have still today, the black and white pictures, very guerrilla tactics. And it's interesting, those folks would come to work, you know, wearing shirt and ties, right? Nice hats. That's how you dressed back then. And these folks, you have pictures of them sitting down, and you always try to look at what they were doing or what were they talking about, right? They did the training. They trained Forest Service employees how to jump, and they started the jump. And there's a lot of stories. I'm still friends with the first smoke jumper, his son, Larry Lufkin. The first jumper out of Washington for the Forest Service was Francis Lufkin. How would you say their mission and task was to show the Forest Service that they can be trained, jump out of a plane into rough terrain, not get hurt, and go function as a firefighter in the backwoods in that country. So they did, you know, 49 test jumps. You know, back then, some people didn't take as much, you know, notes. From there, that's how the program started. I mean, that is the birthplace. We have a sign. We're anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 guests that come to our base in less than 6 months.
And what is the selection process like for somebody that wants to get into smoke jumping?
You know, it's interesting. It's, you know, back in the 1930s, they were hiring, you know, young, tough kids. I mean, right, working on the ranch, working cattle, folks in sports. And today, the process is you have to have wildland fire experience, which they want 1 year. 6 months is a season. So 2 years, plus or minus, is minimum 1 year. So most folks applying for to become a smoke jumper, we're not going to see 18-year-olds anymore. You're going to see, you know, in their 20s, because most of them went out and maybe spent a few years on a hotshot crew or an engine crew. But they have to have that experience, because once you come in to the smoke jumper program as a rookie candidate, we don't teach you how to fight fire. Only thing they're going to teach you how to do is manipulate a parachute and teach you advanced skills. So the folks that are coming in are, in my class in 1999, I believe our youngest was maybe 23, 24. So the guys coming in now are, you know, mid-20s, late-20s, not that many 30s, right? As we get older, we take longer to heal up and get dented a little bit. So the process is a little bit different, but it's not that hard. Folks would get on USA Jobs online, go through the process. And anyone listening that is interested in smoke jumping, my best advice is get on the phone and call bases. I mean, they get paid to answer the phone. If you have to, blow up their phone, show them you're hungry, and do a face-to-face. That's always recommended. Give a handshake, show them who you are, introduction. But that's kind of how it all starts.
And a fire crew, is that kind of what a normal city would have?
Yeah, so we can break it down for the listeners. You know, I was never in the military, but I kind of break it as an analogy. So you have, you know, the Air Force, you have the Army, you have the Marines, the Navy. So hell attack would be like the Air Force. Those are folks on helicopters. They're either going to be hell attack, means they land, they walk to the fire very close, or they rappel. And then you have, you know, air tankers, which they're not firefighters, it's just the pilots that drop the water and retardant. And then you have hotshots, which are like the Marines. They're 20, 21, 22, very highly trained. And those are what you see on national news, guys walking in a big line, chainsaws, hand tools. That's usually what you'll see on any kind of YouTube or national news on fire. So those guys, again, there's a little over 100 crews in the United States. And again, they're amazing folks. They're in shape. As I like to say, controlled savages. They work 16 plus hour days, cutting the line all day long. They're just absolute savages. And then you have engine crews, which you'll see just like at a normal fire station, right? But these engines are usually 4x4s made to go off-road. And that's your four service engine crews. And then you have other types, entities like small hand crews, whether it be type one or type two, that just classifies what type of training they have. So type one meaning unlimited. Those folks are fully self-contained to go fight and be left alone.
Okay. And so once you get picked up to become a smoke jumper, what's the training like?
It's interesting. Everyone has their own memories of smoke jumper training. It's 4 to 6 weeks, depending on what state you get picked in. There's 9 smoke jumper bases in the United States. So, you know, the first day can give a little rundown. You know, you get selected months ahead, obviously. A lot of phone calls. They're going to ask you, you know, how many push-ups you can do. What is your runs like? What can you do in a mile and a half? And what is your skills? What is your skill set? And these folks are writing it down. You'll learn that later. You know, if you become a smoke jumper, it's like, you tell someone you're doing 100 push-ups, they're going to tell you, hey, Mr. Ramos, you said you can do 100 push-ups on February 3rd at, you know, 1501. Why aren't you doing them now? So you go through that whole process. And there isn't, you know, there isn't a video, there isn't a book how to prepare for this. So you train and you train and you train, but you don't really have anything to go off of. So you hear the trainers tell you what to do. But I understand once you go through the process, when you're done, they want you to see how hungry you are. How bad do you want this? Because when you jump out of a plane and you're by yourself, there is no trainers. There is no personal coach. There's no one there to help you. You might be by yourself like me in that video. So the training is in a way that works very well, right? And they've had since 1939 to perfect it, obviously. So that first day when I showed up for training, you're very nervous, right? You get there a couple of days early. I remember getting there on a Friday night, and Monday's the day, right? You do roll call. Everything's very nice. The trainers get introduced. Everything's very calm, relaxed. And they introduce everyone, the trainers, kind of rules of engagement, right? What to do, what not to do, what's asked of you. And I remember one of the trainers saying, this is it, guys. You know, you put all your cards on the table. You're here. There's not many of you since 1939. Still to date, there's less than 6,000 of us that have passed. And you're sitting and you're starting to go, uh-oh, you're here, right? It starts to hit on you. Mm-hmm. He says, the only thing you guys got to do is listen and perform at the highest level. That's it. We're actually going to pay you to do this. You're going to get lunch. You're going to get breaks. We're going to support you. All you got to do is listen, right? And I remember him saying, you know, when you wake up in the morning, you know, smell that milk before you pour it into that cereal, you know, those Cocoa Puffs. And you try not to laugh, right? And so he goes away and the next trainer comes in a little bit more serious. And then once they're done with that, I remember the trainer says, you know, your training starts now. And there was a lot of go, go, go. And I remember everyone getting up out of those seats and tripping and pushing to get out this little door, right? Get to the barracks. And, you know, the order was get in your PT clothes. You're going to go out and do your first test run. And you're like, oh, we're here. So you run out there, you do this, you do that. You do your minimum. So they're going to take you out, do your mile and a half run, your push-ups, your pull-ups. And again, it's still not that crazy yet. Once all that's done, everyone meets that, those minimum specs. And then it starts to get a little bit more interesting. The trainers get a little bit more serious, right? And then the day starts. It's that first week is, again, very interesting. You're doing your 110 pounds, 3 miles, flat level terrain. That has to be done in 90 minutes. Most fast guys are doing it under an hour, 110. I'm 5'6", and my gait is not large, right? So my slow run is a guy 5'8", 6 foot, his slow walk. So jumpers coming in the program, candidates that are 5'6", or to 5'4", you're going to push harder. It's just the way it is. That's the limit. Can't be shorter than 5'4". You can't be any taller, I believe, than 6'4", 6'5". I'd have to look at the specs. So long story short, again, it was hard for me, not going to lie. you come in very cocky, right? You learn during this process to be very humble. There's a lot of humility that gets thrown in your face very quickly. And I remember, you know, training is like, oh, I'm good, man. I feel my sock wadding up and I'm good. And I remember when the trainers, you can see me walking a little bit funny. He's like, you know, Mr. Ramos, you can sit down and take a break. We'll get you a milkshake, you know, relax, quit. This is hard stuff. And I said, I'm not even going to readjust my sock, you know. And I paid for it. I took off the whole arch of my foot. One of the medics looked at my foot at the end. Jeez. And it hurt, right? Hands, fingers, toes are sensitive. Anyone ever get a sliver, nail, open fracture, fingers cut off, they hurt, right? People torture people in the past for your toes and your fingers. And I remember the trainer going, whoa. And I looked down, you know, I kind of looked at my, I said, oh my, are you, you know, it all hits you, right? You put everything on the table. You're in your first week thinking you're going to get washed out now. Now you got to go back to your crew that you came from, right? Everyone's teasing you. So all this hits you. You're sitting on a tailgate. I'm like, just, I'm fine. And he's the medic. He's like, you might need to go to the hospital. Nope. Nope. And he's like, okay, kid. I like that. And the pain, you deal with it. It sucked. It got infected days, weeks later. And you can't go to the, right, see, pull a bunch of medical supplies in the ready room or whatnot, because then they know you're hurt. And then they take you to the hospital. The doctor looks at your foot and he says, you can't go back. And then you wash out. So I went through with a stress fracture on the left leg and a very bad infected foot arch on the right. So I would say the scale is pretty painful. The stress fracture and infected foot.
Yeah, sounds like it. I'm sure 110 pounds doesn't help with that. I remember when I was at the academy, I went to the special tactics orientation course in Hurlburt, and we were doing a bunch of rucking with 45-pound packs, and that was tough. And yeah, one of the biggest lessons I learned is you have to take care of your feet. Walking through those creeks, you always have to dry out your socks and look for blisters and things like that.
Yeah, and I learned my lesson, right? Humility, right? Right in your face. It just smacks you, as my dad would say, like a wet sack of potatoes. And I remember looking back to that day, you know, if I would have just took time, wore the right socks, but you're young, you think you're, you know, Superman, powers above will always remind you.
So you make it through the four to six week training. What happens after that?
So in that training, you know, they break it down. So the first week's kind of like in the PT session to see, those trainers want to see you perform. Like I said, when you get out there and you have a cold or stomach flu, you get hurt. There's no one to call. So that's the first week, right? The physical. Second week starts to get into a parachute manipulation. Third week, you're going to do live jumping usually. And the fourth and maybe fifth. So once you pass all that, and once the trainers say you're ready to go, you know, you're, you know, they'll tell you when your training has stopped. And it's a little bit of a sigh of relief. And now you're ready to, you know, rock and roll. Your name's going to be put on the list. And you are now a national resource to go anywhere in the United States. You can go to Alaska, California, anywhere they need an air resource, a smoke jumper type one firefighter. And usually you're going to get paired up with a senior smoke jumpers, guys like to say old man or old salts, whatever you want to call those folks, someone experienced. And now you're in the system. You're excited. You're still looked at as under the magnifying glass, right, for years. You're still new. And that process starts. And, you know, you're waiting for your first fire. So there's always training during that time. Even though you're done with rookie training, there's always training. Still today, you know, I've been off the jump list for a while. You're still training. You're always training. It just never stops. Mm-hmm. And if you're not that kind of person, the fire service or any other profession that deals with being a first responder or an aviator, right? It's probably not the job for you because it just never stops. So, you know, every morning there's roll call and they go down the list and you learn who your jump partner is. So they call each last name and you can be paired up with, again, your jump partner, and you kind of know that person a little bit. You might know him or you might not know her. You get thrown in very quickly. Now you're by yourself. And I remember a trainer saying that, said, you know, on your first jump, says, ask questions now, because come Monday, on your first training jump, we're not going to be there. It's like, oh. So we wait till something goes wrong. That's what a firefighter waits for, right? We wait for something to go wrong. So we're always training, waiting. We're basically storm chasers. We're hunting down that lightning, where that lightning is going to be, where our business is at. So that's what you're doing. You're, as a rookie, you're waiting, you're on pins and needles. And when that siren goes off or that call, you go back to your training, which you trained for months and months and years for, and you make it happen.
What was that first call like for you?
You know, it's interesting. We had a bunch of dry runs, meaning, you know, siren goes off and we didn't jump, whether it be too windy or they didn't need us, right? It's like a Tesla, I would say. It's 0 to 60 in seconds. Your adrenaline just, it's constantly spiking, constantly going down. And by that time, you know, we get it again. It's like, oh, this is going to be the real one. And we were headed to Oregon for a reinforcement. So that means you're going. This is a going, working fire. We're going to support the Redmond smoke jumpers. And I remember getting on station. So we're over the fire and you look down, you know, and it was kind of a rock meadow. Well, I didn't know at that time. I was a rookie. It's like, oh, piece of cake. And you hear, you know, my jumper saying, oh, it's a scab. It's like, what's a scab? It's like, those are rocks. You know, it's like, oh. So, you know, I remember as the plane goes around, there's smoke. And I remember feeling a little bit of the, you don't feel a lot of heat, but you feel the hot air and you smell the smoke as you're going through, as the plane's orbiting around the fire. And as the jumpers in front of you are getting briefed and they're exiting the aircraft, it's like, God, this is it. First fire. And then now you're the first stick in the door and you get your briefing. And I remember one of the trainers telling me, you know, rookie, you know, stay at the F and F. There was some French. Stay at the F and fire. And you're, you know, your eyes are about this big and big as saucers and headlights. And you're just, okay. And get briefed. And the first jumper goes out. And the second jumper goes out, which is me. And you open up. And those 60 seconds are very quick. Happens very fast, flight time to the ground. You land, you know, your adrenaline is really spiking, right? You're training, you're at one piece, nothing's hurt. You do all your checks, tell your jumper you're okay. You put out your signal panel, which we used to do back then, telling the jump plane we're okay. Gather your gear, get to the rally point, get briefed and go fight fire. And you're pumped. And that was it was a tough fire. I mean, we cut line all night long. I only remember a few hours sleep. I remember cooking some spam and rice and beans and eating that, taking a quick nap, I would say, and we were back at it first thing in the morning. So we were there for a few days and that was my first fire. So it was an interesting, hard, and you always remember it. So.
And that was when?
That was in 1999. So it should have been, I have to look at my logbook, July, August, somewhere in there. So. Yeah.
So there's a lot changed between then and now?
The tactics and operations still the same. You know, we have new technology here and there, but the principle's still the same. Take the food away from the fire. Cutting fire line. So hand tools, funny names like Pulaski, Edward Pulaski, he designed that after the 1910 fires. McLeod's, chainsaws, combi tools, dragon slayers. We go out there and people say, you know, what do you do? And I say, well, basically, we're taking the food away from the fire. We know fire is a chemical reaction, right? But if you break it down, what do humans need? We need oxygen, we need food, and we need to be warm, right? If you take any one of those things away, if I take your food, your water away, you're not going to live. If I expose you to high temperatures or cold temperatures, you're not going to live. I take your oxygen away, you're not going to live. So fire has its own thing. If we take any one of those elements away out of the fire triangle, it dies. It has its own language, right? We don't speak it. We can't translate it. It even goes to the bathroom, what it leaves behind, right? It's black, sooty, kind of stinks. And I remember telling that to a university, and I remember the professor said, Jason, you got a point. It's interesting. I said, yeah. I mean, I'd always tell people, watch the old movie Quest for Fire. Great movie. Got to look it up. Watch it. And you know, we have good fire, right? We have in our fireplaces. We have at our campfires. And then you have bad fire, right? That gets out and eats a lot of things. So yeah, my first fire was a tough fire.
So the tactics. So is the major tactic to, you talk to taking away the food. So cutting fire lines, is that the primary tactic for containing these fires?
It is for boots on the ground, firefighters on the ground, hot shots, engine crews, heli-tech, smoke jumpers. Yeah, we're cutting line. or we might even be burning out small sections of fire. We're dropping trees, cutting trees down. We're doing all these things, again, to make that fire break. Again, take that food away so she doesn't have anything to eat. So, and then the tankers come in, right, that you see on the news, and those folks are cooling the fire, right, dropping a retardant down to break that cycle and gives us time, boots on the ground, to hopefully stop that fire. So the tactics are still, you know, again, we have different technology, but dating back to 1939, they'd have the same thing. They'd have a Pulaski.
Sorry, what's a Pulaski?
A Pulaski is a, looks like an axe, part grubbing hoe. And this was designed after Edward Pulaski in the 1910 fires. So it's a very versatile tool that you can cut down small brush, small trees, and then you can flip it around and dig fire line, grub into the dirt. You become, as a smoke jumper, a hotshot, or a hand crew, even helitech, you become very proficient. Left hand, right hand, those guys that can throw them, very good. I mean, that's your tool. It's kind of your life out there. If you don't have a tool, what are you going to do? So Pulaski is one of our chosen tools for wildland firefighting.
What are some of the other favorite tools that you have?
You know, McLeod, I never liked McLeod. You know, when you're coming up in ranks of firefighter, right, you're going to spend time on a McLeod. McLeod's not very...
Sorry, you'll have to describe that, all these tools.
Yep, McLeod looks like a rake. So part rake with big tongs. So kind of like picture your hand, holding your hand out. All those big fingers would be one side. On the other side would just be a long knife edge. So like a small machete cut in half, like a quarter of a machete. So you can like chop a section of grass and pull that back and then turn it around and use those, I believe there's five or six fingers on there to grab and pull that out. So the McLeod's not a very elegant, it's a tough tool. I never liked it. And then you have shovels, you have combi tools are usually modified, a bunch of funny names like Rhino, they cut them in half. Some crews will modify their own tools to the topography that they're in. So whatever state they're in, they'll have special tools for that state. So like, let's say for certain parts of that might have a lot of lava rock, you might not want a McLeod. You probably don't want a Pulaski or a combi tool or like in Alaska, they use flappers, kind of a big rubber flap to swat the fire up. So you have all these different tools for different places you're going to fight fire. Mostly in the lower 48, you're going to have a Pulaski for smoke jumpers, and then hot shots are going to have the full complement.
And how are you determining how wide to make these fire lanes?
So there's, you know, there's rule of thumbs out there as things progress into, you know, our fire season is getting longer. We have not managed some of our forests. So some of these rule of thumbs don't really work anymore, right? If you have this high of brush, that fire line might not work anymore. Sometimes we have fires that jump literally freeways, right? A freeway. I-15 is out of California, I-215, I-5. So some of those rule of thumbs get thrown out. If it's a small fire, a lightning fire, that's most of our business for smoke jumpers. We call it a small scrape. It's just going to be a couple feet. So it doesn't need to be a member. It might just be me and you out there cutting fire line. So we're not going to do a 4-foot fire line. It might only be a couple feet, as we call, some people call hit and lick or a jumper line. It's not the prettiest line. We'll come back and clean it up. But our goal is to get in there and dig line very quickly, get around that fire and get it contained, and then come back through and we can clean it up. We can make those fire lines bigger in certain places. So jumper, you know, we always get teased even before the smoke jumper. You'd get in a fire if you were lucky to see a jumper line. Like, what are these guys? Look at it. It's horrible. You know, look at there. There's some brush there still, or there's some grass. We're getting through that. We want to get around that fire, contain it, and then we'll come back and clean it up. So remember, sometimes we only have two guys. We don't have 20 behind us with hand tools cleaning up our 4-foot scrape. So it just depends on the size of the fire. Down in Southern California, you know, some of the protocols, those guys will say, you know, captain will say, you know, give me a 4-foot scrape or a 2-foot scrape with a 4-foot aerial, meaning anything high, you know, limbing up trees, any kind of brush, any overhanging, you might 6-foot aerial, you know. So it's all these different training procedures and tactics. It depends where you're at will dictate that fire line.
Yeah, it sounds like it has a lot in common with the military. Can you talk about the mission planning aspects of who's making the decisions, where to drop the fire retardant, where to use the hotshot crews, where to parachute you guys in?
So, yeah, so once it gets into a bigger fire, that's going to be, we talked about the air attack. So those are the eyes in the sky. That person is coordinating the air tankers, helicopters, hand crews, even if they need to be. But most of their job is all the air resources on that fire. So kind of cut it. Long story short is on a big fire, you can have a lead plane. The lead plane is going to fly in front and it's going to make the placement of where that fire line is going to go. So they actually have some cool stuff. They'll lay down smoke and then that tanker behind them will know exactly when to start that procedure. And again, that's all coordinated by the air attack. So they're kind of stacked in the air. So kind of think of a wedding cake, different layers as you go up. Is the different altitudes the air tankers are going to be coming on station, the hell attack, smoke jumpers, retardant planes, rotor work, so helicopters with bucket work.
Yeah, they take water from the swimming pools out there.
Correct, exactly, yep. So the air attack, again, he is, or she, is the incident commander in the air. And they can at times talk to us, boots on the ground as well. So there's different things going on all the time. So that's who coordinates that part of that fire. Usually when smoke jumpers come in or even hell attack or even hot shots on a small fire, you might not have that kind of tiered fire, right? We call them incident command or type fire. So a type 5 fire, type 4, type 3. As the numbers get smaller, meaning the larger the incident. So let's say it's a type 5 fire. You're not going to have an air attack. You're not going to have air tankers. If it starts to get bigger, you could request those. Now it's going to go to a type 4. And now usually there's going to be an air attack, lead plane, and all these other entities within that layered cake to make sure everyone is following that span of control and everything is correctly run because there's a lot of things going on.
And are they coordinating with you guys where they're going to drop you? So I would imagine they're dropping you in the most difficult places to reach. Otherwise, they would just drive a hotshot crew to the line.
Correct. So the smoke jumps, when we get called, breaking into small fires, again, type 5, type 4, there's no one out there, right? Bigfoot. Just us and Bigfoot. So when we're going out there, when we get on station, we're making those calls. The spotter, he's in charge because he kind of turns into kind of an air attack. He is doing the initial size up at information is going to get sent back to the dispatcher, whatever national forest requested us. So let's say we're with the Washington, we got requested to go to Oregon. Once we get on station, he's going to do a size up, small quarter acre fire, burning in timber, rate of spread, any values at risk, right? Homes, anything important, any hazards, life, property. That size up will go to the dispatch, and then from there, we'll go into operations. And that means how many jumpers are going to jump out to that fire, 2, 4, 6, 8 or more. And then once we get out, we're on our own. If that fire goes from a type 5 to 4 or 3, and then we can request those air tankers or air attack, things like that. So usually how it'll happen is, if we went out and jumped a type 5 fire, me and you, and it got big, once we start requesting air tankers, we're going to get an air attack. So they're going to take that span of control over, and they're going to get, more resources, obviously. Now, hotshot crews and all of these things. So there is a process. There is some paperwork involved out there on a fire that can get pretty complex at times.
And what's it like to parachute into these forest fires? We do egress training in the F-35, and basically they say stay away from trees. So you guys are jumping into forests and there are fires going on that are probably changing the weather conditions. So what's that like?
So you asking as the parachute jumping in, or are you asking weather? Where are we going with this?
Let's start in the plane. So what are you thinking as you're in the plane? And also, I guess let's start with where you're going to jump, like how big of a spot you need to jump in.
So this is the interesting part. So in the North Cascades, we don't have much big meadows. So we're in a transition of parachutes. Now, the smoke jumper program at some point will be on a Ram Air parachute. So it's kind of like a plane type parachute, which you see on the movies and on YouTube. Our old round parachute, I like to use an acronym, more like a helicopter type parachute. When I rookied in 99, our spots are very small. So you would land in trees at times. Some guys are lucky or very good. I happened to land in some trees. That was just what happened. And if you do everything right, it's not a hard landing. If you do it wrong, it hurts, right? You can get impaled. You could really get hurt. So if you land in a tree, you rappel down. You have 150-foot of letdown rope, as we call our letdown tape. We have a built-in rappel harness on our suit. You go through your procedures, your letdown procedures. You rappel down the ground. Go fight the fire. Once the fire's done, climb up the tree, retrieve all your gear. We don't leave any gear out there in the forest. So those chutes are not cheap, and they're taxpayers' money, so we take care of our gear. The goal is not to land in a tree, but sometimes it happens. That's why we have the gear to deal with that. Sometimes there's rocks. Sometimes there's cliffs. There's water. I've landed into on the shoreline. It's kind of weird because you're coming in. You know you're going to hit, but how hard are you going to hit? Are you going to break? You're going to hit the water and then hit so hard you can hit the bottom? Or you're deep enough where you're just going to hit and float. And I remember trying to pick a spot. It's like, okay, I don't want to hit, you know, shoreline. I want to take some of the sting out. And just where I landed, I kind of hit water and it hit the bottom. And I remember I bit a little piece, a chunk of my tongue off. Or I wouldn't say off, but hard enough where my speech was slurred. And had a good amount of blood in my mouth. So kind of part of it was a little bit mangled up. And I remember I had tadpoles in my jump pockets, you know, little frogs. So sometimes you land in trees, sometimes you land in water, sometimes you hit rocks, sometimes you land in snow. So you're always looking for that best landing because our legs are our landing gear. You don't want to hurt your landing gear. So that is one thing jumpers are trained at in that 4 to 6 weeks. And your ongoing training is from the process from the plane to the ground, where we're landing. Our spotter is going to pick a great spot for us. He's going to give us our wind indicators, which are called streamers, which they throw out, which are basically a test dummy for what the winds are doing and what we're going to do as we fly through the air as our parachute's opened. Kind of gives us what the winds are doing on the ground. So just like any aviator, we need to land into the wind for the softest landing. If we land downwind, you could break your landing gear or even worse, get really hurt. So you could imagine if some of these chutes are flying at, you know, 12 miles an hour downwind, you might be in your 20s hitting things. It's not good. So we do everything you do and every other Navy aviator out there does. We have to land into the wind. So those are what those streamers are. When the spotter throw those out before any time we jump out of a plane, we have to have the streamers. And they're 20-foot pieces of crepe paper. So if you can imagine a long stream of paper, they're weighed exactly each streamer with a certain amount of sand. And that weight, again, is equivalent to our descent rate when we jump out in our parachute under canopy. So pretty kind of low tech, but high tech at the same time.
Yeah.
20-foot pieces of crepe paper, but with sand in it.
What kind of descent rate are you guys falling at? Because I know in the parachutes that if we have to eject, we're falling pretty fast and there's a good chance you're going to break an ankle.
You know, in training, I remember I was always taught, you know, about 12 feet per second. But it's like, where's that in writing? Is that what we're falling at? You know, and if you do everything right on a round parachute, there was guys that could do stand-ups and some guys would hit really hard. What's really cool about the square, the Ram Air parachute, when these guys do everything right, these guys land very soft. When they do their flare, I mean, it's amazing. It's like, wow, that looks pretty cool. So it just depends. Like I said, Mother Nature, that recipe, when we're jumping out in a dynamic space there, and you have winds and thunder cells and outflow boundaries coming in and squall lines and all these things, right? And relative humidities and dew points and all these things and altitude, right? Higher up, harder you fall. Mm-hmm. So just like when you guys are doing your load calcs, you know, all the jumpers at the base, they know their load calc. They know how much is strapped to them. And if they're jumping around, what size round canopy they need. The square parachute can handle a certain amount of weight. So those guys are really cool with that. And like I said, they can come in really soft. And it's just amazing to see that new parachute of these guys getting transitioned into this new technology, how their skills are just so exacting and getting better and better and better still after over 80 years, right? I mean, it's crazy. It's just
improving a little every day.
It's just, again, I'm proud of the guys. I see them and I tell them, man.
How much gear are you jumping with seems like you're bringing in a ton of stuff. Are you strapping all that gear to your body, or is the plane coming back around and dropping your gear?
So we're jumping out with about 60, 65, 75, 85. Just depends on what gear you're taking. If it's late in the year, cold weather gear, or if you're a medic, or you know, you might have some specialized jumping for that mission. We get guys now that are, you know, becoming drone pilots and all these different tools and tech. So that's what we're exiting the plane with. So you have your jumpsuit and all your gear. So it could be 70 pounds or plus. Once you land on the ground, now the plane's going to come around and drop out anywhere from the boxes are about, you know, under 100 pounds. Just depends what state you're at, what smoke jumper base. So you have a lot of gear, and that's what makes that 110 pounds or more when we're done with the fire, because that's what's everything that left that plane, as I call the shopping cart. So think of the plane's a shopping cart. We all go shopping, right? You throw everything in your cart. Then we get on a mission. You take all that stuff and you throw it out. And everything that comes out of that cart, if it's not consumed, it's going on your back and you're taking it out. So it could be very heavy at times.
When they come back around and drop those crates, who's dropping that and how do they make sure that it lands near you guys?
So those are the spotters, two spotters on the plane. Depends on the size of the plane. So we'll just stick with the, like our plane, Akasa 212. You have two spotters and those guys or gals are going to be throwing out gear, your supplies, for 48 hours. So you could have a couple fireboxes. You could have extra gallons of water, 5 gallon, we call them cubitainers, chainsaw boxes, medical equipment, crosscut saws. If you're in the wilderness, you can't use a chainsaw. So a big, big, gigantic handsaw, right? So those are the folks that are going to drop all that gear out for you on that fire. The plane's going to drop down to a working altitude. They're going to be, it could be 500 feet, just depends on where that pilot's comfortable at. And it's very important for those spotters to work with the pilot at the exact time when we say to kick that cargo out the door. Because if that cargo goes out the door and now goes over a cliff or gets stuck in a redwood that happens to be over 200 feet high, you got to go climb and get that. So It's very important for those spotters and the pilots to be exacting again. When I was active as an assistant spotter, you know, it's usually the pilot's going to say long final, short final, get ready. And then you know his timing. As soon as he says kick or you hear his voice change, you got to have that out the door. Because if you're a second or 2 seconds behind, planes flying 100 something knots, you could have put their cargo over 100 yards away, a couple hundred yards away or all over the cliff. So, and we're nowhere messing with the G's like you, but we're messing with a little bit of positive and negative G's. Sometimes you float a little bit. And sometimes you're way down. And I remember there was times on our approach to let some cargo out. It depends who your spotter is. You might have a lot of weight that you're trying to get out the door, positive G's, and I'm having trouble, right? It's like, get it out the door. And then there's times you're floating, and you would hold on or lock your foot just in the corner of the casa just to make sure you can be stable. And there's guys that have been hurt, bad weather, you know, hitting some turbulence, bouncing up and slamming and breaking things. So the spotters is a tough job.
Yeah, I can't imagine having to hold a box of gear when I'm pulling G's. I just have to make sure I don't pass out. So that's a completely different experience.
Yeah, it's and you get green too. You get airsick. I've never thrown up, knock on wood, yet in my aviation career in the fire service. But man, you get green. You feel horrible.
So since you've been doing this for a long time, what are some of the things, what are the biggest lessons that you've learned and what do you try to pass along to the next generation?
I surround myself with excellent folks, right? You try to at least, right? You seek out those mentors. You seek out those, what I call top tier, tier one folks. And I wish I'd have known that back when I was 17, right? You hang out with these guys or this guy, you train with this guy, and you see guys more exacting, right? Doing better ropes and knots, better ladder evolutions, better this, better that. It's like, that's the team I want to be on, right? You have people's lives in your hands. When I started off as a county city firefighter, and my mentors back then made me who I am today, literally. If I didn't have that kind of mentoring and just being on me, I've seen other battalions and other stations, you know, you look back and those guys are still, they just never got to that next level. That's all. doesn't mean it's bad or good. I just didn't want to be at that level. I wanted to be over here. I wanted to be with these guys. I wanted to be with the guys that are, you know, that looked good. They didn't have their shoelaces dragging on the floor. They didn't lose their wallets every day, you know. They were always good on missions. It's like, that's the guys I want to be with. And it takes work at that, right? It takes work at learning how to tie your shoelaces good where they don't get loose on a fire. So all those folks out there, I'm just saying, I'm not talking down anyone. I'm just saying that, you know, there was a lot of trial and error there. And still to this day, from a lot of my good friends that are owners of some of the biggest companies in the United States, right? They're my friends. And I've learned the research and design and how to do things. And it's just an amazing recipe. And I'm glad to be part of that. And, you know, looking back again, when I was 17, 18, you know, these trainers would tell me, Jason, you could either be this or you can be that. This place, the firehouse, we need excellence. We can't have someone that kind of can pick up a ladder, that kind of could do this. We need this all the time, 24/7. I don't care if you're cold, sick, hurt, right? Your goldfish passed away, your cat ran away, your dog ran away. We're human. We can deal with that later, but on a mission, we need you to perform. So I just remember those little things guys would tell me. And I'm lucky that they, you know, they took me under the side. They saw something in me. I was a snot-nosed punk rock skateboarder, right? 17, 16, getting in trouble and respectful of my parents, but, you know, doing things I probably shouldn't do. So my advice to the kids out there, you know, reach out. My analogy is if you knock on a door, you keep knocking, the door will open. You bang on it, it'll open. Knock it down, it'll open. If you don't knock on that door, I guarantee nothing will happen. That's a fact. Nothing will happen. Whether your career, studying, relationships, anything, bang on the doors. From writing my book to my business to my work with search and rescue or with the fire service, you know, there's days I don't feel good, right? I'm not banging the door loud enough, but I have a big sledgehammer and I like to bang the heck out of it and just knock it down and go forward. there's days I don't want to get out of bed, right? We all have that as well. Find something that motivates you. Like today, I'm dealing with a horrible sore throat and cold. And when I tell people, hey, yes, I'm going to do something. If I don't come, that means I'm probably not breathing. Motivate yourself. Get up. Put your socks on. Go to the bathroom. Brush your teeth. Take a shot of orange juice. Burn the heck out of that throat, right? Makes you feel alive and get out and do it. So just some advice that, you know, things I live on and they seem to work. I'm not saying it's the best thing, but it's working for me.
Yeah. And so what are you taking that passion with? What kind of projects are you working on now?
So, you know, I've been, again, very lucky, man. It blows me away. You know, when I wrote my book, HarperCollins called me. They cold called me. I didn't write a book and go look for a publisher. Just that alone is something that blows me away every day. The amount of respect and honor and just being who I am to get that opportunity, right? And I've taken that with other projects. So when I see something and it doesn't work, it fails, whether it be my fire gear, clothing, shoes, glasses, whatever it is, all my stuff is the best of the best I can find. Because I work hard for my money and I don't like buying stuff that fails. And I remember when I started off at a very young age in the fire department, you know, you'd get gear and it'd fail and it would make you fail on a mission. That's the most horrible thing. So to date, I have a solutions company and I have learned to contact owners, VPs, CEOs. I tell them what I want to do and 9 out of 10 times it happens. It's the craziest thing. And all I do is ask. I bang on the door. And if they're not listening, I bang it harder. Sometimes it takes a year, but I have literally have helped produce, design, and engineer some of the most amazing products that say can never be done. From our pocket weather meters, Kestrel is an amazing company. Their engineers and those folks there listened to a dream I had, and we made it happen. I designed my own fire helmets that said, can't happen. Call the CEO and tell my dream that took years, right? None of this is usually overnight, but there's a way that you start a relationship with someone, you can make anything happen. It's the most amazing thing. So from personal protective equipment for firefighters, I'm always tweaking any firefighter out there right now. I can guarantee if you go to work and you're well on firefighter, there's something that you're wearing that either I help test burn abrasion testing, tech of your weather stations, helmet. I guarantee there's something you're wearing that I helped with. And that just blows me away. The humility of it, it's a great responsibility. And I get folks now that call me, read my book or find me online. I've had physicists that have worked on the particle separator, right? Read my book and call me, right? Say, Jason, how can I help? You got an older gentleman. It's like, you're who? And you know, you research that person. I've had test Air Force pilots that were testing parachutes, and then you research them. It's like, wow, this guy's got the Guinness World Record of this or that, or he does this. So every day is something new.
Is there anything big on the horizon that excites you?
Yeah, you know, I got a few things right now. So, I'll tell folks, listeners out there. So tracking systems for wildland firefighters, first responders, search and rescue, a fire shelter that works at the highest levels, meaning the fire shelters we have now, depending on the fire, you can't guarantee you're going to live. Those are facts. A lot of people argue that. A lot of people get their feathers ruffled. And I tell folks, hey, man, don't put the boxing gloves on with me. Let's put the boxing gloves on and go make a solution. Because if they worked 100%, we wouldn't have folks that have been killed on fires. So fire shelters is a big project. I'm working with some of the best in the world, Jim Roth at Storm King Technologies. And the third is what we call masterclass of teaching folks, wildland firefighters, how to read weather, how to look up and read weather. We've had instances in the past where folks are not that level. And we bring on the best of the best. We bring on folks that literally the best of the world to break it down in layman's terms for our firefighters to understand. So we're getting all these pieces of the puzzle in, and we've done it with some of the weather systems I've done, tracking system. I had a great meeting last week to, you know, get on a PowerPoint with the CEO. And I'll tell you the truth. It puts tears in my eyes. It's like, there it is. There it is. That's what I envisioned. The guy's doing it, right? And I'm just there helping in the words of, you know, how do we make it better for that company? But there it is. I put a book out there and it inspires people to help design. And I remember when I took that deal with HarperCollins, you know, I told him, I said, is it my book or is it going to get changed? Jason, this is your book. This is yours. You know, some weeks are busy. We get a couple calls or emails a week or whatnot, but people read the book and they're part of the solution. So every day is different. Literally from an hour from now, I could get a call and we could have a solution for the next big project. So always doing something, but those are my three for fire in my life. We're trying to get my book out to a movie. Hopefully that'll happen on the big screen and done in a way it's never been done before. We want to give them the real thing, just like the clip in my TEDx there. We want to give them what really happens out there.
And where can people keep up and follow along with you?
So, you know, I'm not that good at social media. I try to keep up on my Instagram. I don't do the other platform. So I'm just on Instagram as Product Research Gear and my Smoke Jumper book. And you can just scroll through it and see some of the stuff, the pictures, what I'm doing. So long story short, people can follow me on Instagram and they can just pick up the phone and call me. I mean, literally, I put my number out there. I don't hide it. If you're going to crank call me, that's all right. I just don't answer.
Jason, I appreciate you coming on. This has been great. So thank you.
Thank you. No, it's a huge honor. And again, I hope all the listeners out there, again, if you're inspired to be a firefighter, doesn't have to be a smoke jumper, you want to volunteer, you don't know how to get in, call me. Again, there's always a way. There is always a way. I will find you a county. I will find you. It's what I did. I know how to do it. I'll give you the ingredients and hopefully you can have a great recipe yourself. So
that's great. Well, thanks, Jason. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, make sure to review it. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot. I've also started a monthly newsletter where I send out a few useful or insightful things that have helped me over the last month. You can sign up by going to professionalsplaybook.com and clicking on the red subscribe button. The link to the newsletter is also in the show notes. Today's episode was brought to you by Bremont, over-engineered watches for professionals. In the last few years, Bremont has taken over as the fighter pilot's watch. Their combination of precision, quality, and customer service is unmatched. You can see all of their watches by going to Bremont.com. Today's episode was edited by Trevor Cabler. Again, thanks for listening. I'll talk to you in 2 weeks.